and made it into a thin shell that we stand on. And now you go inside of that shell, you would experience weightlessness, zero gravity, microgravity. So inside of that shell, you'd experience nothing, because in every direction there would be an equal amount of material, so to speak, attracting you. You'd experience nothing. Now, if that shell had a little bit of clumpiness to it, if it wasn't completely uniform, as you got near one of those clumps on the inside of the shell, you would experience acceleration outward. Well, all of those multiverse, other Big Bangs out there beyond our observable universe has a degree of clumpiness to it. Therefore, some of the material out of the perimeter of our observable universe that's accelerating away from us is accelerating toward that local clumpiness it experiences from that external multiverse universe, so to speak. That's a belief of mine. And therefore, if we carefully measure the rate of acceleration of all the material out of the perimeter in various directions, you're going to see different amounts of acceleration, depending on how much local clumpiness that material is experiencing in that external, in those external multiverse universes. That's a theory. That's a belief of mine. I haven't read that very many places, but maybe some of you guys have who track all these astronomical theories. Anybody got any further questions or comments on this crazy subject? K2RIW, listening.
AC2IS, comment.
AC2IS, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. I thought that there was a big theory about us living in a wraparound universe. In other words, if you could travel far enough in one direction in a straight line, you'd come back to your original starting point. It sounds like that theory contradicts or conflicts with, is in conflict with yours. Do you agree, AC2IS?
It certainly does conflict, Bill. It's my strong belief that if you moved in one straight line direction, you could go forever. And would you come back and eventually see the back of your own head? I doubt it very highly. That's a nice theory that it's a cyclic universe and that everything curves around, that space is curved. However, let me ask you this, Bill. Have they measured any significant evidence of that theory? AC2IS, K2RIW?
I'm not well read in this field, but I thought there was some evidence. What that evidence is, I don't know. Also, you said something earlier about a parametric amplifier. What is it about a parametric amplifier that makes it parametric? Or, you know, feel free to answer that question on some other day if you'd prefer to continue this line of conversation. AC2IS.
AC2GS. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, there's basically three different geometries to choose from for the universe. One is saddle-shaped, one is spherical, and one is flat. So far, experimental methods have shown it to seem to be flat. It seems to behave the way Euclidean geometry is supposed to within a statistical laboratory error. So does that laboratory error mean that it's still round? Like if you look at the Earth, it looks kind of flat, except if you look at it from space, it's obviously a sphere. Or is it really that it's flat? So that's the nature of all the theories at this point in time. And by the way, atomic clocks have proven special and general relativity already, so it doesn't have to be reproven.
Modern-day clocks are so accurate that you can build a pair of them, raise one of them, raise the other, and thank you. opened up that cold sky. The sky is looking at the out of the direction of travel of those signals. Coming back out was stronger, and that was the output of higher. That some of what was taking place there, Bill, and every known attraction that wouldn't want to know, you've got a bill waiting to be.
I think I can keep on asking questions if you're, you know, willing to let me do that. Like, for example, the speculator sounds a little bit like a directional coupler. Are they related to this at all? And how do those two things compare? Enjoy it.
Speculator, the way it's usually instructed, is a device that works by gyrocopy. That's a fancy way of saying that we have a strong global magnetic field and the right kind of a wide field circuit. Signal flowing clockwise around that circuit, signal flowing counterclockwise flows at a different rate. And the right kind of a gyrocopy material is the kind of ferrite. You have two slabs of ferrite, long, wide shaped, strip line circuit, and a strong local magnetic field. And that local magnetic field, this gyrotropy taking place, or a kind of precession. The magnetic field inside of the ferrite material experiences precession. And the precession is either clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on the strong local magnetic field in north or south. So, the bottom line is that the circuit of ferrite material with a strong magnetic field has a different velocity of propagation for a signal that travels clockwise around the circuit versus counterclockwise. When you set things up just right, port number one will transmit a signal to port number two, port number two will transmit a signal to port number three, port number three will transmit a signal to port number one. That's a clockwise signal. The counterclockwise signal, a signal from port 2 goes to port 3. No signal goes to port 1. That's the reverse direction. It propagates at a different rate. So the signal going all the way around the perimeter, the clockwise and the counterclockwise, are out of phase with each other. So a circulator is a drop cone. A circulator is a fancy, combined visually, light circuit with ferrite material and long, strong local magnets, which resonates at a particular frequency. In my case, it resonated at 2.3 gigahertz. And so, clockwise signal went from port number one to port number two, counterclockwise signal from port number two, didn't go back to port number one. That's the isolated direction of noise. So, a circulator allows the circuit to separate signals going in one direction from signals going in another direction. The antenna was connected to port number two. An amplifier was connected to port number antenna was port number one. The paramedic amplifier was port number two. That was port number three. Thank you.
No, I agree with you entirely. It's one of many examples why there's really no such thing as an anti-force carrying particle. The thing that I forgot that I wanted to talk about was cosmic rays. Unfortunately, this comes into the misuse of the English language. Cosmic rays is really sloppy English. It could be alpha particles, it could be beta particles, it could be gamma rays. It's a very sloppy term. Alpha particles are masses. They're the nucleus of a helium that's at a very high, almost relativistic velocity. Beta particles are accelerated electrons close to relativity. Gamma rays are purely photonic, have no rest mass. But it's cobbled together in this cosmic ray nonsense.
Yeah, for those who are listening to the TechNet tonight, it's an unusual kind of TechNet in which we decided to slide into physics, astronomy, cosmology, and whatever. And I can tell by the interest of the people listening that it's a subject that we should pick up periodically, just like we always have a question and answer period. We used to always have a mailbag period. We always have a space report period. And maybe we're going to have a space, we're going to have a physics and astronomy period, which is what we're going through right now. I'm going to break away from this briefly, because we got one of the guys who signed in named Joe, KC2QIW. I'm going to go to his question, and after that, we'll slide back to cosmology again, if that's what the majority of people want to talk about. So, Joe, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this material, different than probably your individual question. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, Roger, Roger. No, love you guys. Love you guys. I guess it's a question or a comment. We got to worry about our Earth over here. People are saying, like, way, way in the future, you know, with all this global warming and all that plastic junk out in the oceans and whatnot. I don't know. If you think about it, there's going to be no more Earth left for the future. That's my, I guess it's a question. That's my question. I mean, way in the future, can this Earth be safe? Or do we all have to friggin' relocate to another planet? Okay, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there are people who are very enthusiastic about the Apollo mission to the moon, saying that we should be colonizing the moon, and after that we should be colonizing Mars. There are people saying that we should be constructing spacecraft that will transport people to Mars, because that's going to be our backup planet to go to if we dirty our nest here on Earth. That's a nice sounding theory for why we should be producing the hardware that can get us to Mars. Is Mars a pleasant place for you and I to go and live? Absolutely not. It's super cold, super low in atmospheric pressure, no local magnetic fields, strong with cosmic rays and solar winds and all kinds of radiation. For life on Mars, it's going to be very, very tough. You don't want to go there. And when it comes to the way we're contaminating the Earth, you easily say, hey, the sky is falling. Let me drop it. And that the Earth is going to become unlivable in the next number of years. You can easily say that. I don't believe it. Are we making life more miserable for ourselves because of the contamination of the oceans? Yes. Can we correct that? Of course. And even if the oceans became two or three times as contaminated as they are right now, and kills a whole lot of fish and whatever, that's a very undesirable situation. It's not the end of the world. We can adapt. We can stop doing the things that are damaging. If the Earth goes a couple of degrees warmer, bad things happen. Yes, it's going to make certain portions of the Earth a lot more unpleasant to live there. You have to go somewhere else. But we can adapt. Is our life on Earth coming to a finite end? You can make a lot of science fiction out of that, but I strongly disagree. This Earth is an awful big chunk of stuff. I think it's a 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. In other words, if you write the number 6 and put 24 zeros after it, that's the number of kilograms of material, of stuff on this planet. And people were talking about stopping the circulation, stopping the spinning of the Earth last week, and what would happen. If you wanted to stop the spinning of the Earth, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. If you used every rocket you've got, you'd be wasting your time. You wouldn't even be able to measure the difference you could make, if you know what I mean. So it's a very massive object, moving very fast in velocity around the sun, moving very fast in circular, the perimeter, the equator of the Earth is moving almost 1,000 miles an hour because of the Earth turning once every 24 hours and 8,000 miles almost in diameter. Let me drop this. That's a huge amount of mass, a huge amount of kinetic energy in both the turning kinetic energy and the energy of it going around the sun. And the Earth is in a nearly perfect vacuum of the space between the Earth and sun. So it's got nothing to slow it down. I mean, you spin your gyroscope and it slows down because of wind resistance and because of bearing resistance. It slows down in about a minute. The Earth has been spinning at its rate for billions of years, and the only thing slowing it down a little bit is the tidal friction. In other words, the moon makes tides, the tide moves a whole lot of water in and out twice a day, and the friction of that tide against the land creates some loss, and the net result of that is the moon moves out an inch and a half every year, and after 50,000 years, the Earth slows down by 1 second per 24-hour day. 1 second per 24-hour day, the Earth slows down in 50,000 years because of tidal friction, and the coupling between the two is moving the moon outward half an inch per year. So billions of years ago, the day may have been 12 hours long instead of 24 hours long, and the moon may have been 20,000 miles closer than it is now. You know, numbers like this. So it's a very dynamic binary system. You could say moon and Earth are a binary system. So are we destroying the Earth in a way that we can't tolerate it? I doubt it. We have to do better things to preserve it. We got to start using cleaner energy, and we are moving in that direction. But the sky is not falling that fast. Don't give up on the Earth yet, Joe. That's my opinion on this. KC2QIW, K2RIW, the 10th man.
Yeah, roger that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't think about that part. So I guess I could tell my kids they can have kids. Yeah, you know? So I guess way in the future I'll be a grandpa. Yeah, that's good to know. And thank you, guys. Back to Dick.
Yeah, tell your kids to try to become green citizens, so to speak. In other words, try to make less pollution, try to do cleaner things, try to use cleaner energy sources. There's a significant disadvantage of using fossil fuels all the time. At one time, we thought we were going to run out of oil. And that was part of what was going on with the oil embargo of 1972, 73 period of time. We thought we were running out of oil. Well, we now know that there's enough oil for a whole lot of years. But there's a certain disadvantage of burning hydrocarbons. It produces carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, and it increases the amount of global warming. And global warming has certain disadvantages. And whether or not we're going to flip over and suddenly create a runaway condition with global warming is something that's being argued. But to use renewable energy has a lot of advantages, both economically as well as pollution-wise, and we are moving in that direction. We are using, let me drop this. As time goes on, we're using more wind, solar, photovoltaic, geothermal, hydro. All of these renewable energy resources are economically viable. They give us energy independence for a considerable period of time. A big percentage of the oil we were using was being imported, and that makes us vulnerable to people who are supplying it. And so for us to become more energy independent, and we can do that. We have the resources to put people to work building windmills and solar voltaic farms and other kinds of renewable, maybe tidal methods. In other words, the circulating water in the Atlantic Ocean, you can put a propeller below the water and suck energy out of that. You're really sucking up solar energy when you do that. So there's lots of ways we can create energy independent renewable energy resources, green energy concepts. A lot of advantage of doing that. So we are moving in that direction, putting people to work doing that. I've been unhappy that we've been doing that too slowly. During the time we had a lot of people out of work, we could have been putting them to work at building all of that hardware. We are moving in that direction these days. And I hope Trump understands the advantage of all of that. If we have any further comments on all of the above, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW and the Tech Net.
P2GS?
You've got it right.
The relative economics of solar versus oil, AC2IS.
Well, we're now getting to the point where solar is around $1 a watt. It used to be a lot higher than that. So better methods of manufacture, it's getting cheaper and cheaper. Is it cheaper than oil? Probably not in pure economics. But that doesn't mean you don't want to do it. The main thing that it gives you is energy independence. As we use more and more solar, more and more wind, we need less and less imported oil. We therefore become more and more energy independent. Therefore, we become less and less vulnerable to worldwide economics and worldwide warfare and so on. For a period of time, we were very dependent on foreign imported oil. And people could really give us a tough time over that from time to time. Roy wanted to make a comment on some of this jazz. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, AC2GS here. Well, the problem with convincing everyone that the Earth can't be made to stop rather easily is everyone's seen that first Superman movie, unfortunately. And even though it's a movie, they kind of absorbed it. There's this great book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that had a great fable of the Golgafringens. Supposedly, they figured out that their planet was going to end. So they built three massive ships, and in one they put the great thinkers, in another they put the great workers, and in the third they put the middlemen. And the idea was to go to another planet, but ultimately what they did was they just shot the one with the middlemen, and the other two guys, two groups, stayed home, and they got rid of the middlemen. So I don't think going to another planet is quite the solution we should think of.
Yeah, I'm convinced it is no solution at all. You look at the specifics of Mars, you really don't want to live there. You wouldn't be able to live there. You wouldn't be self-sustaining there. You need a continuous supply of consumable materials shipped from the Earth in order to dwell on Mars. And the only way you can walk around on Mars is in a spacesuit. And being in a spacesuit is not a very pleasant experience for more than an hour or so, if you know what I mean. You don't want to live in a spacesuit. You don't want to live in a habitat where you're confined indoors because you can't go outside because of the extremely cold temperature and extremely low atmospheric pressure. So, modify Mars, terraform it to make it more Earth-like? We don't have the resources to do that. So you better take care of this Earth. Mars and the Moon are not a solution. And is there any other planet? Let me drop this. Is there any other planet or moon in this solar system where you would want to dwell? I'm convinced right now the answer is absolutely no. Is there a star in the nearest 10 light years which might have a very pleasant planet where you could go to? Yeah, maybe. How in the world are you going to get there? To travel to the nearest star 4 light years away would take thousands of years. By the best techniques we've got today, your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren might get there, but you're not going to get there. So that's not a solution. You better take care of this planet. This is the best one we've got. For the time being, it's the only one we've got for a long time to come, as I see it. And so to live a green life and take care of this Earth is a very desirable thing to do. You're always going to be getting arguments from people saying that you're wasting money being green. That if we be dirty, you make more profit. Yeah, temporarily. But there's always going to be that argument between the green and the non-green people. H-U-R-I-W listening. Anybody else got any further comments?
This is AC2IS, I can maybe continue on solar.
What's your solar question, Bill?
Well, I've heard some people say, and I think this is true, that on some power grids, in some geographic areas of the U.S., there's now so much solar power that the wholesale rate for power has effectively gone negative at peak sunlight hours, and that this has now forced people to make it mandatory for large solar installations to provide energy storage along with the solar energy project. Is anybody familiar with that, AC2IS?
82AMZ with a question.
Yeah, AMZ, recognized. One of the problems with solar is you build a great big solar farm in an area that has inadequate local power transmission capability. You can exceed the local capability, as you might during high noon, so to speak. Not able to use all of that energy because the local grid cannot tolerate it. So you've either got to beef up the lower grid, and or you've got to have local storage, because the good news about solar is you get a lot of energy at high noon. The bad news is you don't get any energy at midnight. So if you can store it during the day and pull it back out of the storage system at night, that's a very desirable way to go. However, storing electrical energy, large amounts of it in kilowatt hours, is not easy. You study how many batteries it takes to store the amount of kilowatt energy that you use in one day in your house. Be amazed how difficult that is. So we need super batteries. We need grid improvements. We need the proper distribution of solar voltaic farms. These are all solvable problems, but they're minor problems. Let me drop this. Okay, we've got two people in the wings now. Who is the one before Eric? Go ahead.
I have a question, Dick. In regards to solar cells, what does it take to make it? How much energy does it take to make one? What does it take to make a solar cell? That's a question I have. One of the other things that I have, we used to manufacture them in Maryland. That fact.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, because you didn't wait for the beeps, you got timed out, so we missed an awful lot of that. But the major question you're asking is the energy consumption to make solar cells, is it still a positive thing to do? And I think the answer is yes, because properly constructed, you can use those solar cells for a large number of years. At the point of manufacture, yes, you use a considerable amount of energy in raw materials and processing to make the solar cell. And if you were a pessimist, you could say, let's never build solar cells because they're too expensive. Well, let's never build windmills because they're too expensive. Let's never build any hydro dams because they're too expensive. Let's never build any nuclear power stations because they're too expensive. You can talk yourself out of anything that has long-range capability. So I don't buy that. Eric, you've got hopefully you've got some good news at all of the above. K-E-Q-E-J, K-2-R-A-W, go ahead, Eric.
K-2-R-A-W, K-2-E-J. I just wanted to point out that batteries are not the only way to store energy. There's a number of pilot projects around different parts of the country where they actually, during the day when there's an excess of energy being pumped into the grid, they actually pump water up the hill and store it in the reservoir. Come nighttime, they run the water down the hill and it runs the same motor pump generator. So there are some solutions, even given the technology that we have today, that allow you to store massive amounts of kilowatts. But it does take a large space, and it does take a lot of planning. But there's a couple of pilot projects around in California where they're actually doing that. WST2J.
WS2N.
Yeah, very fine, Eric. Paul recognized. WS2N, wait for the beeps, and you got a Paul.
Yeah, I know, Eric's right about that, but New York had that many, many years ago. It's a place called Storm King Mountain upstate, and they had built a
built that type of deal. You pump water up on low demand and high demand. So open up the floodgates and, you know, just let it roar through the generators, and you're going to make up that difference. Storm King Mountain was one of them back in.
And Eric, I think there also was a way of pumping up air, so to speak, into a chamber below ground, and that high pressure air was another way of storing energy. So you can store energy below ground, store energy with water being pumped uphill into a reservoir above ground. In fact, the Panama Canal has a very exotic technique of pumping water from reservoirs in order to make the efficiency of those locks much higher, so that the I think the whole system runs on rainwater, but there I'm not sure. Do you know of other ways of storing energy other than pumping water uphill and pumping air into the ground, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, there's more than just that. There's other forms of batteries which we don't use, like zinc air. There's something interesting that I was going to send you an email about, which is a subject for another time, but the Jazz Society at Montreal actually stored some very famous audio pieces in the form of DNA. We'll get to that at another time. I'm going to send you that email for you to really talk about it. Elon Musk is doing is different than, and I can't think of the guy's name, that's taking natural gas and making fuel cells. If you look behind most of the Home Depots, you'll see those units actually there. So it's not a form of storing energy, but it also has a negative aspect that it's releasing carbon dioxide. KQRWK2J.
There are lots of ways of doing it. Rich, KTUPS is going to give us some information. Rich, because it's exciting, please tell us where you are. I'm going to guess you're Mobile, probably in Pennsylvania, and maybe you're heading east. KTUPS, Mobile, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, KTUPS, Mobile. Yes, I am heading east of Pennsylvania. I'm near Dunningsville, which is about 28 miles or so in on I-70 from the Ohio border. I had a comment. It's not so much about storing energy, but creating it. There's an article I had read the other day, and I'm trying to remember, it was either in Spain or maybe South America, at a mining company, and one of these huge mining dump trucks that's bigger than a house goes up the mountain empty on electric power, and it comes back down weighing, carrying 40 metric tons of ore, and using regenerative braking, it creates the electricity that it needs to get back up the mountain again. KTUPS, back to that.
So are you saying, Rich, that the battery power on board that truck will take this empty tractor-trailer truck, which probably weighs 20,000 pounds, and that battery power will allow you to run that truck all the way back up the hill? Wow. What's your guess as to how big that hill is, Rich? KTUPS, K2LIW?
I'm not sure how long the run is to get from where they dumped to get back up where they load again. The vehicle's pretty darn heavy. I mean, you've seen those, it's not a tractor trailer, but it's a dump truck that's bigger than most houses. This huge, you got to climb almost two or three stories just to get into the operating cab on these things. But because of the immense weight that it's hauling back down, it can turn and create a significant amount of power. And that's what it uses to get back again. I thought that was a pretty neat idea.
Rich, do you believe that this supersized dump truck has any backup energy source? If the battery should run down before it gets back up to the top of the hill, is there another kind of engine on board that could take over for that short period of time? What's your guess on that one, Rich? K2UPS, Mobile, K2LIW.
Some of them have a little bit details of the article. I don't know if they mentioned that or not. I'll have to see if I can find it again. You would think they would have to have something like that, sure, just in case. It's just that they're not using a diesel engine, you know, spewing stuff out all day long while this thing is operating. I thought that was pretty clever. I don't know what it cost compared to other trucks of its size, and how much they're actually saving by not using fuel. I would not imagine those things get too good of a fuel economy. And I'm only getting about 5 miles a gallon in this truck, so I imagine they get considerably less.
Yeah, what makes that so unique is that at the top of the mountain is where the ore that they're mining is located. In many cases, the ore that you want to mine is below grade. So it would work in the opposite direction. It wouldn't work in the opposite direction. That's a rare situation where the ore is on top of the mountain. I guess plate tectonics have pushed the ore up there over the last zillion years. The question I was going to ask you. Can't think of it right now, Rich. That is, 5 miles per gallon. You're hauling roughly how many pounds? Your vehicle is what? I'm going to guess your vehicle is 40 feet long total. So, although 5 miles per gallon sounds very low, if we consider the number of pounds of hardware that you're hauling in dollars per pound, it might be very economic. I would guess rail could be a little bit more economic, but rail is not as adaptable. Is that true, Rich? KTUPS, K2IIW, and the TechNet?
Yes, the rail, you're limited. There's few options they can use to get around. There's a problem. I went this past weekend, or past week, I should say, the second trip into Chicago, due to the wildfires burning in California. The freight train that brings our load from California to Chicago couldn't get out of California. So they had to do changes in schedules for many teams. This vehicle is 75 feet long, bumper to bumper, when I'm pulling two trailers. And we don't weigh them, but it can't be any more than 80,000 pounds total. We just go by percentage, how full the trailers are loaded. But they don't... we don't have to go by weight, and it's almost always under anyway. Most of the boxes have a lot of air in them.
That's amazing. Your vehicle is 75 feet long. My ranch-type house is roughly 60 feet end-to-end. So I can picture what 75 feet looks like. That's awfully big. It's close to the center, to the length of the front of my property, and up to 80,000 pounds. So you might be 60 or 70,000 pounds. And rolling at, let's say, 65 miles an hour. That's a lot of kinetic energy. And most likely there is a speed control, an automatic speed control on the vehicle, keeping it at a constant speed, so that if a driver fell asleep at the wheel, I don't know whether or not a modern-day truck has any way of detecting that, and therefore all that kinetic energy could create an awful lot of damage in the town where that driver fell asleep. I'm sure this is something you've worried about a little bit. Is that true, Rich? I know that when I once borrowed somebody's great big truck to haul some power sections that I wanted to acquire, and it had an automatic speed control, I worried about that, what would happen if I fell asleep at 2 o'clock in the morning while I'm hauling all these power sections. KTUPS,
K2RIW, the TechNet. KTUPS Mobile. Well, I've had a very simple device for years. I've never used one, but they are available. That looks like a hearing aid that clips on your ear, and it's basically a mercury switch. So that if your head, if you nod off and your head drops, this thing emits a loud beep to alert you, to wake you up. That's been available for quite a long time. There is new technology that I don't think is standard in any trucks, but it can be retrofitted in aftermarket, a system that monitors the driver's face and can determine if his eyelids are drooping even before he does nod off. They can detect the symptoms of falling asleep before you actually fall asleep, and then it would alert you with either, you know, vibrating steering wheel sounds, maybe a light. So there are items that can monitor that and help alleviate that, but head-on collisions is not a good thing, or if one of these things goes off the road, they can cause a lot of damage, and I've seen some nasty accidents out here.
Yeah, when it comes to a tractor-trailer truck, maybe a tandem one, getting into an accident because of driver fatigue, driver sleeping, driver error, I'd like to believe that's a fairly rare event, but that kind of event, I am guessing because there are so many tractor-trailer trucks moving at any one instant of time, there must be a certain number of those per year. Is that true, Rich? And if I did the right kind of a web search, could I find some of the statistics on that? KTUPS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I'm sure there's tons of data available online, but I personally think that there are more accidents due to distracted driving than there is from the drivers falling asleep. That is still a problem, but I think distracted driving is more of a problem.
And those distracted drivers could be the other four-wheel vehicles on the road cutting off a tractor-trailer truck, which creates some pretty serious problems. Okay, I think Roy does have a mailbag question tonight. As you know, if you've got a question for the mailbag because you don't yet have your license, you can't get on the air, don't have the right equipment to talk to us directly, by going to the website of TechNet at ac2gs.com. I'll repeat that. TechNet at Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. com. At that address, you can ask your question for the mailbag. And I think Roy might have a mailbag question tonight. We'll find out. AC2GS, possibly with the mailbag tonight. K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, this is AC2GS, and I have our first question for the mailbag, and it's a very curious one. It's from a gentleman who hasn't gotten his license yet, and has the following question. Can a grounded antenna system be reversed? So instead of the signal being radiated through the atmosphere and the ground being the counterpoise, can the signal be reversed so the energy is radiated through the Earth's ground with the atmosphere acting as the counterpoise reflector?
For the most part, I think the answer is no. Not too different from what happens when you try to operate radio equipment from inside of a gold mine, for instance. When you're below ground and you try to send a radio signal at normal frequencies, Earth-like material is extremely lossy, very absorptive. It's a volumetric resistive material. If I took the 2 meter signal that you and I are listening to each other right now through the air, and by various techniques I could bury an antenna below the ground, and if I'm smart enough, I can perfectly impedance match that antenna so that every watt I put into the antenna is radiated into the soil. So I've got one antenna buried in the soil in my backyard, and in your backyard in Brooklyn, you have another antenna buried below the soil, and both antennas are running at 100% efficiency, one-to-one standing wave ratio. If I radiated a kilowatt of energy to that Earth, and you and I are separated by a fairly small number of miles, probably 30 miles, would you hear it through the Earth? I think the answer is no. The little bit of signal that you would get, Roy, let me drop it. Because my antenna would be buried, let me pick a number, 5 feet below grade, 10 feet below grade. A little bit of that signal would leak up to the surface of the Earth and get radiated into the air. And that signal that got radiated into the air, some of it would travel through the air to your backyard and then get back through the soil by the laws of reciprocity and get back into the antenna. So the strongest signal that would get to your antenna in Brooklyn, buried below grade, to my antenna in Huntington, buried below grade, The strongest signal would be the one that gets through the air, and that signal through the air, I'm going to guess, would be 100 decibels stronger. That's a lot of S units, compared to the one that goes through the Earth. So you can radiate a signal from the Earth if you want to. It ain't going to get very far. If you did it with super low wave, long wave frequencies, super low frequencies, very long wave frequencies, you'll do a little bit better. But since Earth is a resistive volumetric material, it is a beautiful built-in dummy load. 1 cubic foot of Earth at 2 meters is going to suck up 99% of the energy you put into it, radio energy you put into it. It's a great dummy load material. Because it's such a good dummy load, to use it to propagate your radio signal is, in my belief, essentially out of the question. Interesting science experiment to find out how many feet through the Earth can you get a signal above threshold. I think it'd be very difficult to get a signal across your backyard between two buried antennas. That's my belief on that one, and now you know what it's based on, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2JIS, Roger.
Mr. JIS, a very highly overmodulated signal. Start up.
Repeater, timeout.
I think it's AC2JIS, something like that. Start off with your full set of call letters and your name, sir, and then your comment. K2RIW listening, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. My name is Roger. Call letters Kilo 2, Juliet, Alpha, Sierra, Johnny Appleseed, K2JAS. And the question had to do with going back to some of the original discussion. With the Uri Miller experiment, if you know what the outcome was. The experiment dealt with creating an original Earth atmosphere and trying to create life. So back to you, Dick. Again, the name is Roger, Kilo 2, Juliet, Alpha, Sierra.
Oh, very fine, Roger. We're going to go to your question right after we finish this one with Roy about the man who wants to put an antenna below ground. So we're going to finish that one first. So, AC2GS, Roy, K2RIW, I wonder if you feel the way I do, that Earth is a beautiful dummy load, and to try to propagate a radio signal through it at normal VHF frequencies is very difficult. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, I agree with the answer to the question that you interpreted as, but I don't think that that's quite the question he's asking, and I think it's stranger than that. He's just sort of talking about how you take an antenna connection and you flip them, and now the ground supposedly is at the antenna, and the antenna is at the ground, and he expects the antenna to work in reverse. But if you think of things like balanced antenna output, there is no plus, there is no minus, there is no directionality. Whatever you plug into the antenna radiates on the antenna, and whatever you plug into the counterpoise, as long as you don't bury it deep into the ground, is going to be radiated off the surface of the Earth. So I think you're overthinking it a touch. I don't think he wants to know